We dealt with seven arguments from skeptics and showed that in each case, their arguments were not sufficient to stop believing. Then we have begun the seven reasons for faith, and we're on number five. This is a precious one, one that I look forward to sharing with you. This little book that you might want to just set aside some time after you fill it out. And remember, kind of a crude illustration there on the back, but Christ dying for you, perhaps with this lesson, the very cross of Christ will mean something more to you than it ever has before. Let's look then at the beginning, the unbelieving attacks on the cross. And just a couple of comments then. Mahatma Gandhi said, "I could accept Jesus as a martyr and embodiment of sacrifice and a divine teacher. His death on the cross was a great example to the world. But that there was anything like a mysterious or miraculous virtue in it, my heart could not accept. My point is, to accept Jesus only as a martyr embodying sacrifice relegates his sacrifice to an encouragement to bravery and strong conviction." In other words, pretty much just like any martyr who was standing for what he believed in, whether it was right or wrong, to say that he stood for what he believed in even though they killed him. That's about it. To accept him only as a teacher implies man's innate ability to follow his teachings. But he didn't say he wanted them to follow his teachings, but he wanted them also to follow him, that he was the way. To accept him as an example begs the question, an example of what? You see, if we take him as the example of the one who gives his life to God, that's a good example to follow. But if his death is just an example, we have to ask, what an example of what? So this attack on the cross reduces Christ's death to one more good man killed for holding to his chosen belief. The average skeptic might say, "Why couldn't God just forgive us? Why would Jesus have to die? It sounds like the vengeful gods of primitive times who needed to be appeased by human sacrifice. It is divine child abuse." Well, this attack on the cross minimizes the debt of sin. If our sin against God was no more than forgetting to say hi when we passed on the street, he might just let it go. If our sin was serious enough to incur the debt of death, then somehow the death would have to be paid. To picture it as a vengeful God picking on hapless humans or an abusive father guilty of child abuse is to betray an ignorance of the Christ's deity. While Christ the Son is not God the Father, both are Jehovah God. The Jehovah God who punished is the same Jehovah God who was punished. This is him taking the penalty on himself. A Protestant denominational leader, speaking in the 1990s, said this, "I don't think we need a theory of atonement at all. I don't think we need folks hanging on crosses and blood dripping and weird stuff." This attack on the cross supposes that Christ's sacrifice was some additional and unnecessary ornament of Christianity that can be dispensed with if we focus on the main issue, whatever that may be. So we want to look at the meaning of the cross in a couple of ways that perhaps we haven't thought about it before. Point B then is this, and if you are ready with your writing instrument, true forgiveness demands suffering. True forgiveness demands suffering. I'll give you a material example. If a friend borrowed your car, though your insurance does not cover other drivers, and he got into a fender bender accident and he had no insurance, there are only two proper ways to deal with the situation. I was thinking I better put proper ways because, you know, you could go steal another car. I mean, that would take care of it, but it wouldn't be a proper answer. So the two proper ways to deal with it, you may expect him to pay for the damages, or you can forgive him the debt and pay for it yourself. Notice, whether or not forgiveness is given, the debt must be paid so that you can use your car. If you choose to forgive, it demands that you suffer the expense of repairs. All right, that's the material example. Let's move it over then to number two, an emotional example. Most of the wrongs done to us cannot be measured in terms of money. Perhaps you were robbed of happiness, opportunity, or freedom. Perhaps someone damaged your reputation, peace of mind, or sense of security. If you were seriously wronged, you recognize within your spirit that a debt is owed to you. The guilty one ought to pay for what he did. Again, there's only two responses you can have. One response is to hold the wrongdoer accountable. The other response is to forgive him and suffer the agony of not exacting revenge yourself. To suffer that, basically letting the person go, is a true agony. But why would you choose to suffer again just to forgive the perpetrator? The reason is that it is the only way to really hold the person accountable. To take personal revenge without forgiveness causes serious problems. First, you will become harder and colder, more self-pitying and self-absorbed. Second, you will typically color others like the perpetrator the same as him. If he's wealthy, you'll dislike and resent anyone of wealth and influence. If the person is of a different group, opposite sex, different race, another nationality, you may become permanently cynical and prejudiced against all like him. And third, if your revenge is perceived as unjust or overly strict, the friends and family of the perpetrator will feel they have a right to retaliate the same way. It becomes a Hatfield and McCoy feud for years. God calls this fighting evil with evil. The wrong does not disappear. Instead, it spreads. And most tragically, it spreads into you, defiling you and your character. What began as righting a wrong ends up with increasing wrongs. If you seek to hold the person accountable after forgiveness, you will confront the wrongdoer with specific goals. For instance, you may try to reveal to him his blind spot of a damaged character, or encourage him to repair the damaged relationship, or at worst, to restrain him and protect others from him in the future. These goals, you will notice, are reasons of love. To urge repentance and change can make things right, or at least better. Love desires the best for the wrongdoer, or if he will not change, it wishes the best for society that has to deal with that wrongdoer. Now, you cannot say you want him held accountable, but really seek personal vengeance, because the person you deal with will clearly see the difference and then will set up that whole cycle of retaliation. It is only when you lose the need to see the other person hurt that you have any chance of bringing about real change. So, my point then is, forgiveness demands suffering. You must decide to suffer a death to vengeance to experience the resurrection to a life of reconciliation and healing. God calls this fighting evil with good. All right, taking it then from the human, let's go to the divine, the spiritual example. God is the greatest good. Any good and perfect thing found among men has come from God. If we, being evil, know how to forgive and absorb all the debt of the wrong done, how much more does God know? The triune God was seriously wronged by us. His amazing love motivated him to pay our debt himself. Doing this took extraordinary measures. There were layers of suffering added to suffering. Christ left heaven. Just stop there. What kind of suffering was that? Suffering of loss. Became as one of his own creation. How humiliating. accepted the life of one of the least of men. He didn't come as the Maharaja in a palace. Suffered misunderstanding and rejection. Was betrayed by friends and suffered one of the most horrible of deaths. His death was not just an example of love. I think that's such a goofy statement. If a friend says he wants to show you how much he loves you and then he jumps to his death out a window, you're not impressed with his love. Rather, you're depressed with his irrational thinking. However, if you are drowning and a friend jumps in, saves you, but then is caught by the current and dies, you are forever amazed at his loving sacrifice. There's an example of love, you see.
The jumping to your death for no reason to show love sounds like a Van Gogh example.
Yeah, cut off his ear. Because of his love. Christ was paying the debt you owed just because of his desire to forgive you. All right. Look with me then at point C, another fill in the blank. Five words this time. True love demands personal exchange. True love demands personal exchange. God reveals to us that he is love. Love defines his being. Ephesians 2, 4 through 7 explain that God went to the cross for us because of love. He wanted to demonstrate his love, his grace. Without the cross, there is no God of love. The idea, why couldn't he just forgive? Why couldn't he just love us and forgive us? You can't have love without the cross. God's definition of love is very different from some human definitions. God's love sacrifices self for the good of the loved one. And this concept of sacrifice is built into the definition. Number one, human examples of personal exchange. True love demanding personal exchange. Good parents show this love to their helpless, dependent children. Bad parents value their freedom and interest over the child. A good parent limits his freedom to pour himself into the life of his child. And we see this automatically, right? When we just recognize this. Here's that little baby, can't do anything, a little toddler. And the parent that Jeb was talking about, his foster children there in Oregon, and that the children were terribly, terribly underdeveloped, and the parents set them in front of him, strapped them in a chair and put them in front of a TV and left them there all day. Didn't want to mess with the kids, you know, don't interfere with my freedom. Bad parent, you know, that's the definition. A good husband restricts his freedom and desires to protect, support, and love his wife. A good wife shows love to her husband by restricting her independence. A loving family accepts severe limitations to their life to care for an aging parent. Severe limitations. A loving counselor absorbs the emotional grief of a damaged person to give that person a measure of the counselor's own strength. Personal exchange. Personal exchange. Some movies portray the innocent man being chased by secret agents or the government, and he finds someone who is his only hope. Our choice is like that. You can choose to turn away from the man and let him die, or you can choose to help and take on the risk of being killed yourself. And so there is a personal exchange in that love. Well, let's look at the divine example of personal exchange then. John Stott in The Cross of Christ said this: the essence of sin is we human beings substituting ourselves for God, while the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for us. We put ourselves where only God deserves to be, God puts himself where we deserve to be. You see, the personal exchange, substitution. While we do not really understand the cross until we grasp that Christ did not just suffer for us, he did, but not just for us, he also suffered with us. He could have suffered for us by appearing in the clouds and receiving some shock of pain. Instead, he became like us and suffered the same violence and oppression and grief and weakness and pain that we must suffer in this sin-cursed world. He honored God's justice by suffering for us in our place. He identified with us, oppressed by sin's curse, by suffering with us, taking part of the human misery and limitations. Christ once explained the difference between man's goals and his, Luke 22:24-26. And there was also a strife among them, the disciples, which of them should be accounted the greatest? Sounds like our gang comedy, you know, but who's the greatest? And he said unto them, look, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But you shall not be so. He says, that's not the way we do things, lording over others. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. The younger was the servant. David had to go watch the sheep. He that is chief, let him be as one that doth serve. He says, you want to be great, figure out which one of you does the greatest service. I bring this up is that's counterintuitive to human understanding. We say, if I have a stronger position, I can tell other people what to do. I'm in more power. I win. Notice what Jesus accomplished on the cross, exposed and defeated the world's quest for glory and power and status. He overcame by seeming to lose, from man's point of view. He triumphed by entering into defeat. He achieved power through human weakness. And he came to ultimate wealth, that is, retaining his godly powers and ruling everything, by giving away all he had. The devil himself didn't see that coming. He accomplished both justice and mercy at the same time. For justice, he suffered to forgive, as we were talking about. And for mercy, he personally exchanges our inability for his total ability. Christ, in his dying weakness, cried, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" Christ, in his resurrected omnipotence, answered his question. It was to save you. That's why. Why he had to suffer. Hebrews 2:9. But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. So the cross, thinking of it as the way in which forgiveness must suffer, and that true love has that personal exchange. The cross showing us the perfect example, the ultimate example of both of those. Comments or questions?